I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 26th of March. Voting this hour of the program, last week in Oregon, the Motor Voter Bill passed. The state will use driver's license information to automatically register voters, and it could add some 300,000 people to the voter rolls in that state. We'll be talking with people who know the intricacies of the law and how it came to be and worked for it to come to be. Also, we'll be talking with the Brennan Center for Justice people. They say in the past 5 years, we've seen the most extensive attack on voting rights since the Voting Rights Act was signed into law in 1965. Since 2011, every state but one has considered legislation that would make it harder for many eligible citizens to vote, and half the states passed new voting restrictions. The U.S. Supreme Court in the last few days refused to take up a challenge to Wisconsin's voter ID law. We will talk about that. And we, of course, will look at President Obama's comments last week in Cleveland, where he spoke about the importance of middle-class economics and was asked about the issue of voting and mandatory voting. He said it would be transformative if everybody voted, and it was the first time that he had shared the idea publicly. So what would happen if everybody voted? That will be one of the questions we'll ask this hour. We'll have three guests with us, and feel free to join in on any of those areas of discussion. Two of our guests are from Oregon, and we'll talk about the motor voter law later in the hour. We will be speaking with a guest from the Brennan Center, and we'll be looking at the national issues. The deputy director of the Center's Democracy Program will be joining us. She leads the Center's work on voting rights and also on elections. Two guests with us this first half hour of the program. Nathan Howard is the interim director of the Bus Project in Oregon. They sat down with Secretary, she's now Governor, Secretary of State Kate Brown, and pitched this incredibly ambitious idea, which we will hear about. Nathan has also worked as Finance Director during the 2014 election cycle, and before that, Chief of Staff to Senator Mark Haas, with a focus on education, environment, finance, and revenue public policy. Nathan, we thank you very much for joining us. Hello.
Hello. Thanks
Hi.
For having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. Thanks very much for being with us. Also joining us, the Communications Director for Oregon's Secretary of State, Tony Green, and he joined the agency in 2013 after working as the Chief Operating Officer in that office and in the Oregon Department of Justice. For 22 years, he reported for the Oregonian newspaper, covering legal issues, politics, and crime. Tony, thank you very much for being with us.
Very happy to be here.
Nathan, let's start with you. In 2009, you sat down and talked about this incredibly ambitious idea, which was what?
So the idea back in 2009, and we've been talking about this in Oregon for two decades, is simply how do we go about getting a ballot in the hand of every eligible Oregonian? That's the idea. And I think, you know, in other states, there are different routes. In Oregon, the clear route was to make sure that we can get folks registered online, make sure that's happening. The Bus Project worked with Secretary of State Brown, now Governor Brown, on that, and a variety of other policies that led to the new motor voter. So this is, you know, the expansion of the Motor Voter Act that President Bill Clinton signed into law 22 years ago, furthering the relationship between DMVs and the Secretary of State, the DMV and the Secretary of State, so that we can get a ballot to folks who want one.
So this will mean, Tony, from what I've read, that you may be adding 300,000 people to the polls. How come so many?
Well, actually, that's just a start. There's an estimate in Oregon of about 800,000
wow.
Eligible but unregistered. That's pretty standard. That's about roughly 25%. Most states are well within that range. The 300,000 is where we're going to start, but we expect to continually be adding voters virtually every day.
Mm-hmm. So tell me the nitty-gritty of how this works. How do you get registered?
Well, right now when you go to DMV in Oregon, you have to provide proof of age, residency, and U.S. citizenship. So in effect, you have already proven that you are eligible to vote. So now, instead of requiring voters to then fill out an additional paperwork, their voter registration card, Our elections division is simply going to obtain that information from DMV. We are then going to put people on the voter rolls, send them a notification that they have proven that they are eligible to vote, and they don't have to do anything if they want to be registered to vote. If they, for some reason, don't want to be registered to vote, all they have to do is return a postcard opting out.
Mm-hmm. And Nathan, I know on the bus tour thing that you've been doing for years now, you found a lot of people who were not registered to vote. What were the reasons you found for people not having registered? It'll be easier now, but why didn't they before?
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, the bus project has been registering voters since 2002 in Oregon, and the common theme that we hear is that people, they're not registered. They're very excited that we're helping them get on the rolls, and they just didn't know about how to go about registering. It changed a little bit when we had online voter registration come into law in 2009, but for a long time, and we're still seeing it today, people just don't know some of the processes they have to go through to get registered. The other common theme is that people believe they are registered, especially for young people or people who move often and college students. When you move to a new address, you have to re-register. And that, that isn't clear. That isn't really clear all the time. So there are a lot of folks out there who are expecting to get a ballot, vote by mail in Oregon, because they registered last year, but they moved to a new house, and so they're not registered. So really, this is a game changer in terms of keeping people on the rolls, getting a ballot, making sure they have a voice.
Mm-hmm. Tony, though, people will still be moving quite frequently. Does the DMV keep up with that? How will they track new addresses?
Well, there are a couple ways. When people move, the rule is you're supposed to change your address with DMV and with the voting rolls. So to a certain extent, we're going to have people who are keeping up on their own. But we're also involved in Oregon in another multi-state project called the Electronic Registration Information Center. And what we're doing is sharing information with other states so that we can better track who's in Oregon, who's left Oregon, who's registered, where their primary residence is. So we're going to be working on the other end of this to have the most up-to-date voter rolls we possibly can.
Mm-hmm. So say now you go to vote in an election next November, and you're doing this through the DMV, so you're registered, the system is in place, but you moved down the block or you moved to another side of town in the course of the past previous 6 months. What happens to you then? You walk in and you explain to somebody that you moved, or won't that create confusion?
A couple things. I mean, the way it works now in Oregon is you don't have to go to vote because voting comes to you. We mail the ballots.
Oh, right.
And it arrives in the mail, and then you have about 2.5 weeks to return it either through the mail or there are drop boxes and elections offices throughout the state. If you have moved, the post office has been instructed not to forward the ballot, so it comes back to us, and we know that that person is no longer at that address. Now, because they are registered, they can still call up the elections office at any time up until the polls close on Election Day and get a ballot. Because they're registered, they're still going to be able to vote, even if they've moved. The one tricky thing that a lot of people don't know, and unfortunately they discover too late, is that in Oregon we have a 21-day cutoff in the Constitution for being registered to vote. If you miss that deadline, you are not going to be allowed to vote. And that's one of the things that really motivated this law. We, in the last two federal election cycles, saw about 29,000 people who registered to vote after the deadline and therefore were not able to cast a ballot.
So you don't have, is there a movement to have same-day registration?
There are people who've talked about it. There are some practical difficulties. Because we're a vote-by-mail state, we send ballots out 3 weeks prior to the election. Elections offices save a lot of money on personnel based on the certainty that we don't have polling places. Same-day registration would require additional funds. It would maybe isn't the perfect match to vote-by-mail. We think the new motor voter is the way to get there. We're going to have near universal registration this way, and same-day registration works very well for states with primarily polling place elections.
Mm-hmm.
But in vote-by-mail, sometimes you need to have creative solutions, and that's what this is.
Mm-hmm. How did vote-by-mail come into being? How long have you had that?
It was initially put into place by the 1981 Oregon legislature, and it was originally for local elections only. And like a lot of states, we have our primary, we have our general, but we used to have elections in March and September for school measures and school boards and local governments, and we were seeing extremely anemic turnout at those elections during the 1970s. There is one legendary election, a small school district in a rural county. There was a money measure in the ballot, and exactly two people voted. Husband and wife both voted yes. The money measure passed.
Oh, my gosh.
So the vote by mail was designed to address that particular problem. What happened is I think no one could have predicted how much voters really liked it. And the legislature expanded it to cover primary elections. They allowed people to become a permanent absentee. And eventually, and I think appropriately, the voters in 1998 decided we just want to have all of our elections by mail. And they did that by ballot measure, and we haven't looked back.
Hmm. And do you like that system, Nathan?
Yeah, we love that system.
You do?
The thing that Tony is mentioning about same-day voter registration, it is a little bit tricky. It becomes almost cost prohibitive in some ways, so we're trying to see if we can make that work. But right now, the goal is, instead of having same-day registration, to capture as many voters as possible to get people a ballot and give them as many voices as possible so that we don't have to worry so much about same-day. And we find that young people also really like vote by mail because they're able to get together with their friends, their colleagues. They all have their ballots, and they're able to talk about the issues. And that's really the most exciting thing about New Motor Voter, is that for organizations like the Bus Project and other civic organizations that care about the issues and care about making sure that people have a voice in the political process, we're now able to shift towards issues a bit more. So instead of, being in the weeds of voter registration and helping people fill out their paperwork, and there will still be some of that, but in large part, we're going to be able to focus now on issues, on the things that people care about, and the shift towards talking about real things we also think will increase voter turnout. And a lot of that will happen when people have their ballots and when they can look at the actual measures and the candidates on their form.
Mm-hmm. Tony, did this pass swimmingly and easily in the state of Oregon, or was there a great deal of dissension?
Unfortunately, it was largely passed on a partisan basis.
I
think a lot of people think they know how this is going to play out, but the truth is we don't know. These people have not been a part of the process for the most part, and our view is they are entirely up for grabs, both for ballot measure campaigns, for political parties. Sometimes things pass that way initially. A vote by mail at one point was viewed as favoring Republicans. Later it was viewed as favoring Democrats. The truth is vote by mail favors whoever is motivated. In Colorado this past election, in their first all-mail election, Republicans did very well. It's how you vote doesn't tend to play out partisan over the long haul, even if people fight over it in the short term as if it does.
Mm. And what kind of turnout do you have in Oregon?
We have reasonably good turnout. Let me amend that. In this past cycle, relative to the rest of the country, we had extremely good turnout, both among registered and among eligible voters. Where we have struggled is with eligible voters, because fully a quarter of them in Oregon are not able to cast a ballot on Election Day because they weren't registered prior to the deadline. Our registered voter rate likely will almost certainly go down, but really the important measurement is the eligible voter rate. And we are extremely confident that, particularly with groups like the Bus Project out there providing information and educating voters, we're very confident we're going to see an increase in eligible voter participation.
So do you still need the Bus Project, Nathan?
Yes.
You do.
We still need the Bus Project. I think as noted briefly, it's an exciting time in Oregon. We're looking at 300,000, potentially more, new voters in the state by the 2016 election. So we'll have the primary election, the general election, to talk to well over a quarter million new people, voters who may have never seen a ballot before, want to have more information about our initiative process. So I think it's going to be more important than ever for the bus project, for other organizations that do the type of work we do, to make sure that folks feel informed and feel educated to weigh in on the political process and tell, our government what they want. And we do actually have a bus, I should note. That is where the name comes from. When we first started, we heavily focused on loading up a bunch of, young and young-at-heart people who cared about politics, who wanted to make, as our slogan goes, democracy suck less. And we would get them on a bus, and we would go to districts and go to counties or school districts that are working on school bond measures, and we'd go out and have person-to-person conversations on the door or at farmers markets, and often we would do in voter registration. In 2015 and 16, we're going to focus a bit more on issues. I think that's exciting for the bus.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both of you. We're talking about voting this hour, and we're starting our program with something that took place in Oregon last week. The new governor of the state, Kate Brown, signed a motor voter law, and it links voter registration with citizens who are applying for a license or an ID card. It uses the Department of Motor Vehicles database. It should, as you heard our guests explain, significantly increase voter registration, and they already have vote by mail in Oregon, so it's an entirely different system than we're used to here in the state of Wisconsin, but it will open up the voting rolls. And it was, as you heard our guests say, a partisan vote, Republicans voting against this and Democrats voting for, but there's no indication that voting by mail and that this opening up of the voter registration, nobody knows if more people will vote Republican or Democratic. So get your calls in on this segment of our conversation. We'll broaden this in just a little while with somebody from the Brennan Center. But if you have questions about Oregon and what they've done, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about what's been going on in Oregon where, when it comes to voting, some very interesting new legislation in that state. And we have two guests with us. Joining us by phone, Nathan Howard is the interim executive director of the Bus Project. In 2009, they sat down with then Secretary of State Kate Brown and pitched this idea, which is now a reality. Tony Green is communications director for Oregon's Secretary of State. And we're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Starting with Dave from Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. What happened here when the motor voter law passed in 1993? Prior to that, like when I was in school and getting my license in the early 80s, you showed up for a class in summer vacation. And some of the teachers from the school were the people that were the driving instructors. There were cars. We used the parking lot of the school, and then the streets of the city with the teachers, and didn't have to bring any money or anything. It was funded through the school by taxpayers. And after that law passed in '93, there was a big shift here, and that program was defunded and privatized, so now it is a private company. So when my kids went to get their license, it was through a private company, cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars to get a driver's license. Then when they finally get their certificate, you can go to the state and pay the state for what you need to pay. And it was just a block. What they tried to do is just Governor Engler here tried to stop people from being able to register by privatizing that driver's ed program here in Michigan.
Mm. What kind of system do you have? Let's go to you, Nathan. You've worked with young people. Are there impediments to getting a driver's license, to training, et cetera, like in Michigan?
Yeah, well, in Oregon and in Portland, the metro area, where most of Oregon's population lives, or at least a very large portion, we are seeing kind of a different impediment, and that is that young people, more than and the millennial generation, more than any other generation, are choosing not to get their driver's licenses, not to drive. Not to say that the majority don't, but more than any other generation, we're choosing public transportation, we're choosing biking and walking. And I think what that means is that we'll still be doing voter registration. We'll still be out there talking to people about the issues they care about and then letting them know that if they want to have a voice, they have to register. Now, one thing that I think, Tony and the Secretary of State and our great governor might know more about is the potential to have the new motor voter in Oregon expand a bit further to potentially other state agencies. And if that happens, if that's the case, which has been talked about the last couple of years, then I think we'll be able to reach out and touch more of the younger voters through those departments and get them registered. If not, then we'll still do voter reg.
What kinds of agencies expanding to where?
So if someone goes into state legal aid department, they're seeking legal aid, and that could be an avenue for them to be registered. And as Tony has mentioned, everyone has 21 days to opt out to get a piece of mail. And there might be other ways that we'll work on helping folks opt out, and they can always opt out by calling the Secretary of State. And there's other agencies like the Department of Human Services, DHS. So I think there are ways to reach more young people. But if it, as it stands now, is just the DMV, then we'll still be on college campuses. We'll still be at farmers markets talking to people and helping them register.
Right. Let's go to Tim next. Tim is calling from Madison. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Very, very interesting program here. A couple of questions. Now, does this have kind of a purpose? Is it to make it easier for people to vote or get people that otherwise wouldn't register to vote, get them registered? And then another thing I have, you'd mentioned earlier on, maybe I misheard you, about once people have their driver's license, then they're a U.S. citizen, which is not the case in Wisconsin. It's not the case throughout the U.S. Well, maybe Oregon is different, but in Wisconsin, you are not required to be a U.S. citizen to get a driver's license. And then one other point, and I'll hang up and take the answers off the air. So the politicians, the people running for election, do they have access to this new pool of registered voters? And how does that affect their campaign? Do they take advantage of that in their campaign? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Thanks, Tim. Tony, you want to take it?
I'm going to leave the first question to Nathan, the one about sort of the purpose of all this. I can address some of the logistical issues he raised. Oregon is one of the states, and I don't know the number, that have adopted this, but in Oregon you are required to provide proof of legal status in order to obtain or renew your driver's license. I'm just trying to, his last question, I'm suddenly pulling a blank. Could you remind me what it was?
Do you want to pick up on the other ones, Nathan?
Yeah, I think what I'll say is that those were good questions and good comments. In terms of the big idea, why are we making it easier for people to register? Why are we looking now at having an additional 300,000 voters on the rolls? And just to give some context, voter registration drives, nonpartisan voter registration drives, happen pretty frequently throughout the country. And in Oregon, if we register 15, 20, 25,000 new voters in an election cycle, it's huge. I mean, it's a game changer, and it's something that people pay attention to, and I think often generates, news stories. We're looking at well over a quarter million. There's no better way to frame it than a game changer in terms of giving people a voice and making democracy work better. And I think there are so many things that we could talk about in terms of why it's important. But a big thing that our president, Barack Obama, mentioned recently is that one of the best ways to combat money in politics in an era of post-Citizens United where we can have unlimited campaign contributions, one of the best ways to push back against that is to have people vote, is to get them weighing in. That's the best way to counter it. And so we're looking at, over time, in Oregon, through the new motor voter, getting to the low to potentially mid 90% of eligible Oregonians being registered. So it is a historical moment. I mean, mm-hmm. especially in the context of the 50th anniversary of the March on Selma that brought national attention to the plight of, you know, African Americans in the South and throughout the country, the anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, and then also the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act. I think it's a bright spot in many ways in a new era of voter suppression.
And his other area that he wanted you to comment on, Republicans or Democrats, how they will be taking advantage of this larger voting pool.
Right, that's right. Under federal law, those who are registered to vote, the basic information is a public record. And what you see is that campaigns, both for candidates and for ballot measures, buy that information. And what's interesting in Oregon is you can also, they'll buy it repeatedly so that they'll know that, okay, these people have already voted because their ballots have already come in, so we don't have to call them, we don't have to go knock on their door. When people complain about political mail or political phone calls, it's very simple in Oregon. Just get your ballot. As soon as you get it, send it back, and you will be off their list.
Hey, how about that? One more call for you, the two of you, and then we'll go to the Brennan Center. Walt in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I support the ease of registration, but I do have two concerns about mail-in ballots, and that is, first would be, because it's not a secret ballot, you're filling it out at home, for instance, there could be somebody who's a domineering person in your household, a spouse or a parent, who kind of talks you into, forces you to vote the way they want you to vote. Or maybe your church, everybody votes together, and everybody has to vote the same. The other concern is when you don't have a private secret ballot, somebody could pay you to vote. And so you get your $20, you vote the way they want you to, and they can verify that you did vote that way. When you have a secret ballot, they can't verify. They can't know for sure how you voted. So my two questions are, first of all, do you provide a way for people to vote secretly? And second, have you seen any problems with people being coerced into voting, maybe the way they wouldn't vote if they weren't
right.
coerced?
Good question, Walt. Tony?
Yeah, I can answer that. I mean, let me begin by saying that we have had fewer than a dozen cases of any type of voter fraud since we went to all vote by mail in 2000. And so we're talking about tens of millions of ballots cast and a tiny, tiny fraction of various types of voter fraud. So the evidence is that it is simply not a problem. Now, anybody can vote confidentially. I mean, technically everybody votes confidentially. You sign it, put it in a secret envelope, and then mail it in. So it's still a secret ballot. But if you felt that you didn't want to fill out your ballot at home, you could go into the elections office, ask for a ballot, fill it out, seal it in the secrecy envelope, and hand it in. So it's something that can be addressed very easily. I always sort of get into the first question and then neglect to remember the second one. What was the second question you had?
Well, the second... The two questions were, have you seen a problem, and do you provide a way? So you answered them both. You said
okay.
You hadn't seen a problem, and you do provide a way for people to vote secretly. I guess I just wonder, how would you know if somebody's been coerced to vote or not? How would you ever know that?
Well, it's like our entire criminal justice system. Victims need to come forward, with very few exceptions. If people don't report crimes, it's very difficult for law enforcement to enforce them. And so we would expect that given the millions of ballots that have been cast over the past 15 years, that if this were any sort of a problem, we would have heard of it.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Interesting things happening in your state. Thanks, Nathan and Tony.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Nathan Howard, Interim Executive Director of the Bus Project in Oregon, and also joining us from Oregon, both of our guests were Tony Green, and Tony is the Communications Director for Oregon's Secretary of State. You can get more information if you Google what's been going on with voting in Oregon, where they now have this motor voter law, the DNR DMV, sorry, thinking of the DNR, the Department of Motor Vehicles and voter registration are linked. So, and they also have vote by mail, so it's a whole different way of voting. We're going to continue our hour-long conversation on voting and switch to what's going on in other states in this country and what's going on with registration and voter ID laws. And we'll also ask for a comment on President Obama's comments in Cleveland last week about the possibility of mandatory voting in this country. What would happen if we had mandatory voting? Our guest now is Myrna Perez, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, leads the center's work on voting rights and elections. She is the author of several nationally recognized reports and articles, including Election Day Long Lines, Resource Allocation, and If Section 5 Fails. She serves as an adjunct professor of clinical law at the NYU School of Law. And we thank you very much, Myrna, for being with us. Good afternoon. Hi, Myrna, are you there? Oh, she's not there quite yet. We'll still be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Myrna, there you are.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Thank you so much. You have, the Brennan Center has said that voter registration remains the single largest barrier to participation in American democracy. These figures are really, really large. 50 million eligible Americans can't participate in elections because they're not registered to vote. And in some places, registration times have been shortened and it's not as easy to register to vote. Talk about what's taken place the last, say, 5 years.
Sure. So over the past several years, politicians in states across the country have passed new laws that make it harder for millions of eligible Americans to vote. Since the 2010 election, in fact, we've seen 21 states have new restrictions in place. And as you mentioned, these laws range from restricting registration to cutting back on early voting, or to limiting who can participate to who has certain types of documentary identification. This problem has been compounded because we currently do not have the same kinds of federal protections for the right to vote that we have enjoyed in past years. In 2013, the Supreme Court issued a decision which gutted in a really important part of the Voting Rights Act. So we are in a place where the right to vote is heavily contested, and we see new restrictions being introduced and strong pushes in certain states for new restrictions. But as you just finished talking to some folks in Oregon, that's not the whole story. We do see some states trying to make it easier for voters to vote, and my hope is that we move all states in this country to a place where their goal is to make voting more free, fair, and accessible.
Maybe I'm not reading this correctly, but it seems to me as though this has become a heavily partisan issue. So in states where you have Democratic control, usually there are attempts to open the voting roles. If you have Republican states, there are voter ID, there's a lessening of registration. Has this become excessively partisan, and why? Or maybe I'm off base. Maybe it's not partisan.
Well, there are some issues that are partisan. We have seen that a number of the restrictions that have been passed have been taking place in states that have what we would call like uniparty control, or states that saw serious increases in participation by minorities. But nonetheless, we still are seeing some measures, generally technology-based, that seem to be getting attention from both sides of the aisle. So, for example, online registration, the idea of voters being able to vote from their home or, you know, through a smartphone, and there are measures on the back end to make sure that the person who is registering is who he or she says she is. That is something that we are seeing gets bipartisan support. We are seeing efforts to make sure that government agencies like the DMV, who have to provide voter registration services by law, are doing so efficiently. So instead of handing people a piece of paper once they've already given all their information to a DMV clerk, for example, who has already input the information into the computer, instead of handing the voter a piece of paper saying, do you want to register to vote, they ask the voter, do you want to register to vote, and that information gets electronically sent over.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of reforms save a lot of money because you don't have to deal with people trying to decipher illegible handwriting or trying to figure out, you know, what that smudge mark means. And you don't have to pay people to do the data entry. It also makes the rolls more clean because you don't have the kinds of errors that get introduced when someone has to decipher somebody's chicken scratch or
right.
Try and figure out what that stain underneath that coffee spill was. So the rolls are more accurate. They're cleaner, and it's less of, less expensive. So those are the kinds of reforms that we are seeing gaining support from both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And at this stage, you know, in the considering like the mood of the country, I think those reforms are things that we should be pushing for because anything that makes our registration system more efficient, more effective, better in line with serving voters is a good thing. And if that's where we can get bipartisan support, we should push that. I also want to mention the idea of restoring voting rights to people with criminal convictions.
Okay.
You know, I think most of your listeners probably know that there are about 4.5 million Americans who are living and working in our communities who cannot vote because they have a criminal conviction in their past. And there is growing support from both sides of the aisle that that is un-American, that the idea that we are a country of second chances, and when someone has served their time and are back in the community, they should be given the rights and obligations of citizenship. And voting is an obligation, it's a privilege, it's a right. And when people are voting with a criminal history background, the research suggests that they're less likely to recidivate. And it makes sense, right? Because voting is a very pro-social behavior, right? It's pro-social activity. It's saying that you understand that there are certain rules of the game. You understand that we resolve political differences in this particular method. You're willing to wait in line. You're willing to think about yourself as part of a larger community. Those the act of voting is very pregnant with very good civic virtues.
Right.
And I think people from both sides of the aisle are realizing that there is a great advantage in having our people who are returning to our communities engaging in pro-social behavior. So, for example, in Maryland, there is a push to make it such that people, once they're back in the communities, get their right to vote back. And, you know, there was very robust bipartisan support in the early stages. Now that the campaign is actually moving along, it's unclear whether that bipartisan support will hold. But in Minnesota, there are actually people associated with very, right-leaning political groups that are in support of this issue. We even have had Rand Paul speak out in favor of this issue. We've had Rick Santorum speak out in favor of this issue. You know, if we're going to be a country of second chances and be a country of personal responsibility, one of those things is voting, and we should want people who are returning to our communities to vote. And so I think that is another opportunity for bipartisan support.
Let's look at voter ID for a moment. As you know, the Supreme Court on Monday of this week rejected the challenge to Wisconsin's voter identification law. How many states have moved toward voter ID? And I guess that in Texas, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe in Texas you do have to pay to get a birth certificate, and that requirement was lifted here in the state of Wisconsin, so you need to pay to get that, and you don't need to, this can be free, the process is free. Are there a lot of states that now have voter ID? Why did the Supreme Court rule as it did, and what do you think about it?
Well, I mean, I think there's a, your statement has a bunch of really interesting pieces that we need to unpack. Not all voter IDs are the same. So, for example, there are some states, and, you know, Florida or Michigan come to mind, where they ask you if you have an ID. And if you have an ID, you're supposed to present it. But if you don't have an ID to show, there are other ways in which you can vote. There are some states where you can vote, but it doesn't have to be government-issued ID. They'll accept a utility bill or an affidavit saying that you are who you say you are. The ones that are causing the controversy, the ones that cause the lawsuits, are those laws that really place strict limitations on what kind of ID you're allowed to show. So it has to be government issued. It cannot be expired, or if it is expired, it's only recently expired. It has to be, you know, it's associated with the kind of identification that you need underlying documents for, like birth certificates, and those cost money. Those are what we call strict photo ID laws. And those, the states that demand them are demanding a type of identification that up to 11% of eligible Americans do not have. So Texas is an example where they had a photo, they had a voter ID law. They had a voter ID law in place for a very long period of time. Their own law enforcement professionals suggested that maybe during that period that it existed, there might have been two cases, you know, in the entire state of Texas, of folks that may have been deterred if there were a stricter law. And then they went and enacted a strict law, and a trial court found that up to 608,000 eligible Texans did not have that kind of identification. And moreover, for folks who didn't have that identification, to get that kind of identification would have been extraordinarily burdensome. Not every county in Texas has ID issuing offices. Some people would have to, we presented evidence of folks that would have had to take hours and hours long trips
yes.
in order to be able to get the identification. We had some people that were willing to testify under oath that they would have had to make decisions between feeding their families and producing the kind of money that was required for this identification. And those are the ones that cause trouble. I don't think that there's any dispute in this country that people should be who they say they are, and that we need to take reasonable common sense measures to make sure that those who are participating in our election system are doing so in a proper way. But once we start imposing restrictions and putting in requirements that, you know, that poor people, that people of color, that elderly people, that students can't satisfy, we cheapen our democracy because we don't have the richness and the voices of all of those that are participating.
So as you see it, the remedy to this would be for the Congress to take on a stronger Voting Rights Act, a Voting Rights Act that perhaps some have said the U.S. Supreme Court with their decision was saying to Congress, listen, you need to update this, and they haven't done so.
Well, there's no one silver bullet. I mean, I think there's a couple of things that we as a country should consider, and they come from principles that I think are not controversial. I think it is not controversial that we should have the best democracy in the world, and that means using all of the tools of modern technology in an efficient and effective way to serve voters and to reduce the costs for taxpayers. I think that's one principle. I think another principle is that our elections should be free, fair, and accessible, that Americans who are eligible should be allowed to participate. And then I think the third principle is that we don't want politicians manipulating the rules of the game such that some people can participate and some people can't. And all of those three strands are interconnected, but they have different solutions. For example, updating the Voting Rights Act so that we had robust federal protections would put some limits on those politicians in state houses that want to manipulate the rules of the game so that some people can participate and some people can't. But even without deliberate attempts to stifle voting, we still have a lot of people who are unable to participate because of mistakes, because of unreasonable burdens, because we rely too much on paper in our registration process, because there are administrative errors. And there's a lot we can do to improve those as well. We could have states aspire to have like an Oregon-like model, which you covered in your last segment. We could have states to resolve to figure out how to make the voting process more consistent with modern-day life. And I think if we look at the different ways in which we can improve our election system, we'll find that all of these efforts will be reinforcing. So efforts to make there be fewer mistakes and fewer errors, you know, at the local level will make it harder for politicians to justify rules that that allow some people to participate and some people not. You know, Congress taking a strong stand saying that, you know, we believe in the right to vote. This is something that's important to our country. We're going to pass a law that makes it harder to restrict these rights to votes. That will be sending an important signal to everyone that, you know, voting is not something to be trifled with in this country. Our right to vote is not something to be trifled with. It's not subject to, it shouldn't be subject to partisan manipulation and partisan, you know, battles, and that too, I think, will have an important effect in how we administer elections in this country.
Myrna Perez is our guest this part of the show, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. We're talking about what's happened from the Supreme Court in various states to restrict voting rights in this country. We're going to have to do another whole show on mandatory voting because we just didn't have a chance to get there. So, and it's worth an hour anyhow, so we'll do that down the road a little bit. But if you would like to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision rejecting the challenge to Wisconsin's voter identification or what's been happening with states, or if you want to continue, do we all need a model like Oregon, which will make registration a whole lot easier, voting by mail, but voting by smartphones, all of that, what would make it easier to increase the rolls, which I would imagine most people would say is a good thing for more people to vote. 800-486-8655. Call right away because we're getting really short on time. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And if you want to join us in the last couple minutes here, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. If we could, please, let's look at the issue of race in all of this in our last couple minutes. The push to restrict voting coming after a surge in participation among African American and other minorities in 2008. The more a state experienced increases in minority and low-income voter turnout, the more likely it was to push and pass laws cutting back on voting rights. Would you like to comment on that?
I'm sorry, are you asking me?
Yes.
I would say that it is unfortunate that there are some politicians who see a personal or partisan advantage of trying to keep some people from participating and some people who are not. And that is why I think it's especially important that we put pressure on our legislators, both at the state and federal level, to not only protect the right to vote, but expand access through some very common sense ways. Again, we can find certain measures that will both make it easier for voters to get on the rolls and will accomplish some very sensible objectives like reducing costs, making the rolls cleaner, making voting easier. And I think those are where we need to look, because I do not believe that this is a country that at its core wants to stop certain people from voting. I think we have made a promise to our citizens through the 15th Amendment, through the 14th Amendment, through the incredible courage of things that we saw at Selma and that we're celebrating even today, that when somebody steps into the ballot box that they can be free from discrimination. And we have some people that are seeing an advantage to be gained by appealing to some baser and craven instincts, and we need to move past that. And I think we can move past that. We just need to demand courage of our legislators, and we all need to go out and vote and support those legislators that are willing to stand up to folks who would try and create a different kind of America that's not consistent with our values.
We hope to get to this hour, but there wasn't time. But do you have a position on whether or not we should look at mandatory voting or not?
I think it was smart for the president to be talking and looking at bold ideas. We do have a problem where not as many people are participating as it should be. We have a very small number of eligible Americans that are actually turning out to vote, and I think we need to do something about that. The approach that I would look to first is improving our registration system so that we don't rely so much on paper, that we use technology, and that we don't put unnecessary barriers in front of the ballot box. But I do think this is a time where bold ideas should be explored, and we should be having a national conversation about what we need to do to get more people participating.
Thank you, Myrna, very much. Myrna Perez, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. She's also Adjunct Professor of Clinical Law at NYU's School of Law. We will do a show in the next couple of weeks. Should we be considering mandatory voting? That'd be an interesting show, wouldn't it? Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production in Milwaukee.